Oh, wow. Thank you so much for being here. I am honored and grateful to be a part of this this historic event at a historic moment in history. You know, we live in a world with a toxic food culture in which eating foods that are heavily processed, that are depleting the planet, that are depleting our bodies, that are robbing us of the vitality and the joy that we deserve is normalized. And in which agriculture has become the most environmentally destructive force on the planet. And within this context, we have immense power and immense opportunity. I'm just going to adjust the camera so I'm a little bit bigger here. Okay, there we go. We have immense power and immense opportunity to claim our voice, to make conscious choices that turn the tide. And I am here to say that the real truth about health, I think, is that our food choices are a key that can open the door, that can unlock enormous potential for a completely different experience of life than we think is normal in the modern world. And that is really good news. You know, there are so many problems in the world that feel overwhelming, sometimes even unconfrontable. But when it comes to what you eat, you have power, you have choice, and you have the opportunity right now, three times every single day, to vote with your knife and fork for the health you want and for the world you want. And I think that is such a liberating, such an empowering, and such a beautiful reality. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that today. I know you're hearing about it throughout this conference, but we're also going to share some stories and some of my experiences from being on kind of the front lines of the food movement for really my entire life. In fact, my story goes back even before I was born. My grandpa founded an ice cream company. It was called Baskin Robbins, 31 flavors. And my dad, John, grew up with an ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in the backyard and 31 flavors of ice cream in the freezer. He was groomed to one day join in running the family company. But when he was in his early 20s, he was offered that chance and he said no. And he walked away from a path that was practically paved with gold and with ice cream to, as we jokingly say in our family, follow his own rocky road. And he ended up moving with my mom to a little island off the coast of Canada, where they built this one-room log cabin. They grew most of their own food. They practiced yoga and meditation for several hours a day, and they named their kid Ocean. And they almost named me Kale, by the way, and this was way before kale was cool. But we did eat a lot of kale and cabbage and carrots and other veggies from the garden. And as I got a little older, we moved to California. And my dad began working on a book called Diet for a New America, which came out in 1987. It inspired millions of people to look at their food choices as a chance to make a difference on the planet. And one of his readers ended up being my grandpa, Irvin Robbins. Now, my grandpa had lost his brother-in-law and business partner, Bert Baskin, to heart disease when my Bert was just 54 years old. And so, you know, I never knew my dad's uncle, Bert. I just know about him from family stories. And I know he was one of the most successful entrepreneurs in American history. He also had a family he loved. And yet he ended up with his life cut short way too soon, leaving his wife a widow and his kids fatherless because he didn't have his health. So now my grandpa was on a similar trajectory. At the age of 69, he had serious diabetes, heart issues, weight issues. His doctors told him he didn't have long to live unless he made some big changes. But then they give him a copy of my dad's book and he reads it. And my grandpa, who was one stubborn cookie, who probably had more investment in thinking there's no connection between diet and health than just about anybody ever could, he made changes. He ended up slashing his animal product consumption, giving up sugar, eating way more fruits and vegetables and whole plant foods, and getting massive results. He ended up reversing his diabetes, reversing his heart disease, losing a bunch of weight, getting off a ton of medications he had been told he would have to take for the rest of his life, living 19 more healthy years. So we've really seen in our family, super personally, that when we follow the standard American diet, we get the standard American diseases, like happened to my dad's uncle, like happened to my grandpa. But we've also seen what can happen when we make a change, that we can reverse these illnesses and we can turn these things around. And as my dad's work spread, the media had a lot of fun with his story. They called him the rebel without a cone. They called him the prophet of nonprofit. And we had at one point, he put a little thing in the back of Diet for New America, a little page that said, hey, if you're interested, inspired by this work, contact us. And we got a PO box and people started sending letters. And then we had to change it to a PO drawer And then felt in California, where this post office box slash drawer was located, we ended up having to come in every day to get boxes of letters because there were so many people writing in response to the book. And I think we received over 20,000 handwritten or hand-typed letters. This was back before computers were hardly available at all, from individual real people, no emails. There was no website saying, thank you for changing my life. And the stories were pouring in from people who had read this book and felt that it had saved their lives every single day. And so a movement was kind of born out of that. An organization was founded called EarthSave out of that, which my mom and dad started in our living room. And I was at the age of 14. I was stuffing envelopes and helping out, you know, to try to get this thing going, organizing volunteer parties. The movement continued to grow and expand. In the 5 years after Diet for a New America came out, consumption of beef in the United States dropped by 20%. And when my dad was on national television with in a debate with a leader from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the guy on the other side says, you know, the host cited that statistic, and the guy said, it's his fault. So I don't know if it was my dad's fault or what, but I do know that we got to be a part of an exciting moment in history. A movement, however, that was just beginning then, that has actually been going for quite some time, but we got to be a part of that wave. And now there are new waves and new waves and new waves as the movement to rethink how we eat, how we treat animals, how we treat the earth is exploding. As more and more people are saying enough is enough of feeling like crap, is enough of seeing ourselves as exploiters, seeing the human animal as one that oppresses and tortures other animals, as seeing the human animal as one that consumes to its own demise. We see ourselves almost sometimes like a cancer on this earth, as we're on resource consumption overshoot. Every day we have less forests and less topsoil and more carbon in the atmosphere and more pollution and less drinking water available, more guns and bombs. But here's the thing. We also have more knowledge. We also have more awareness of what's happening. And we have more studies coming out telling us the truth about how our food choices affect our health and our world. Every day we're learning more about what's possible. So while we are, it seems sometimes almost on a one-way road to oblivion, obesity rates going up, cancer rates going up, sickness going up, health and happiness going down, at the same time, we can turn that around. We can be a part of the solution on planet Earth. We can be a part of the solution in our own lives. We can take charge of our health. And that really is what the food revolution movement is all about. So coming back to the family story, when I was 16, I was inspired both by my grandpa's journey of transformation and also his legacy of accomplishing big things. I was inspired by my dad's path of integrity. And I was also inspired by the power we could have as humans to make a difference. So I founded a nonprofit called Yes, working with young leaders on leadership development around the world. And I worked with leaders in over 65 countries for 20 years, traveled all over the globe. And I learned so much about how the world works and how people see the world from very different perspectives all over the planet. And also, what is the common heartbeat of humanity that we all have in common with all of our differences of religion and class and nationality and politics and ideology and culture? There are certain things that we all seem to have in common, like everybody I've ever met wants to live, wants to love, wants to have their families and their loved ones be safe, wants clean air and clean water and a clean environment around them. Everyone I've ever met wants health. Nobody wants to be sick. Nobody wants to be miserable. Nobody wants to be a destroyer in a way that doesn't somehow add. Everybody wants to somehow contribute to the world around them, however they define that. Some people's circle of compassion is very small. They're just thinking about number one or their family or their company, but everybody has something they care about and something they're willing to do something for. And my experience is that the vast majority of humans, when given a choice between being a part of cruelty and violence or being a part of healing and hope, will choose healing and hope. And that gives me a lot of heart. As I traveled the world, though, I did see that everybody eats and that what we're eating is having this enormous impact. I saw that the American way of growing food with pesticides and hormones and GMOs and animal factories was spreading around the world. I saw that the American way of processing food was spreading as McDonald's and KFC and Baskin Robbins were spreading around the globe, and as processed junk was spreading, as packaged junk was spreading all over the globe. And I saw that as the standard American diet spread in every country on earth where it spread, rates of chronic disease were going up. There are no exceptions to this. Every country in the world that has adopted a more American style industrialized diet with more added sugars, more processed flours, more fried foods, more bottled oils, more animal products, especially from factory farms, as this has spread, rates of cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, type 2 diabetes, and obesity all go up. And so as this spreads, and as I was seeing this, I was thinking, wow, what we're doing from this one country, 5% of the world's population, is sending out ripples that are changing the way that people eat all around the planet. People are wanting to be more like us. They watch our movies. They go to our restaurants, and this is what they think Americans are. And I wanted to like say to the world, like, don't follow us. We know where this path leads. We see it because the United States, for all of its incredibly advanced healthcare technologies, is not a healthy country. In fact, we have the world's highest rate of obesity of any population on the planet. We are no longer living longer. Life expectancy has topped out. In fact, it started going down in the last few years, but we are definitely living sicker. In fact, we die longer. And most of us live many, many years past our prime in ever-increasing decrepitude and suffering and misery. The average American senior over the age of 65 takes 12 prescription medications every year. We take drugs to deal with suffering and symptoms of disease. Then we take other drugs to deal with the side effects from the first drugs, and then other drugs to deal with the side effects from those. It's this cascade. And here's the thing, we spend more money on healthcare than any population that's ever lived by far. In fact, it's 18% of our gross domestic product. There is no other country in the world that spends more than 11% of its gross domestic product on healthcare. And yet our healthcare outcomes are quite unfortunate. In fact, by many metrics, the United States is 50th, 60th in terms of its healthcare outcomes compared to other countries. And yet we spend so much more. And you know, if we could just be like the, say, second most expensive healthcare system country in the world and spend 11% of our GDP on healthcare, we'd save $1.5 trillion a year, which happens to be double the defense budget in the United States, just by being, you know, number two, right? But for all this spending, we're fatter and sicker than ever. In fact, more than two-thirds of our population is overweight. And we think this is normal. So as I traveled the globe and I saw what was happening in our country, and then I saw how it was spreading, I was like, what do we do about this? And so in 2012, I moved on from that nonprofit and joined with my dad directly in launching Food Revolution Network. And so for the last 11 years, we've been focused on food, healthy, ethical, and sustainable food for all, more specifically. And so now we have more than 700,000 members. We host an annual Food Revolution Summit. We've got one coming up very soon. If you go to foodrevolutionsummit.org, you can register for your spot for it. We're going to be interviewing 24 of the top food experts on the planet. Summit's being kicked off with welcoming words from Paul McCartney. And this is one of the ways that we bring together people from all walks of life to spread the truth. We have online courses and a website with hundreds of articles and hundreds of recipes and a membership community and lots of other resources. Our real goal is to change the way the world eats. Our real goal is to help us move from a toxic food culture to a healthy, health-supporting, life-affirming, positive food culture. That's really what we're up to. And I am so grateful to be able to do this work, not just with my dad, but with so many other people who are really helping to lead the charge towards a new way of eating and living on this planet. And I want to let you all know that this food revolution is taking off, that we are participating in and also witnessing an explosion of interest in organic food, local food, fair trade food, non-GMO food, and of course, plant-based food. Huge explosion in this. Then the sales of plant-based meat alternatives have more than doubled just since the start of the pandemic in the United States. It's going mainstream as we're seeing. Fast food restaurants are starting to serve plant-based burgers. That does not make them health foods, but animals are certainly not killed in the production of them, and the environment's better off, and it is a step, and I think an important step towards opening the door so that people can start to break our dependence on the meat industry to nourish our bodies and for our caloric support. And so it's an exciting time, really. The number of Americans who identify as vegan has actually increased 30-fold in the last two decades. It's gone from a few hundred thousand to more than 10 million. The number of people who identify as plant-based or, you know, plant-forward or plant-powered or other such terminology is also exploding. And this isn't just in the US. The number of people who identify as vegan or vegetarian in Portugal, in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in many other countries is exploding. The Chinese government has declared that it wants to reduce meat consumption in China by 50% in the next generation. And we'll see if that happens. But as we all know, the Chinese government can make a lot of things happen when it wants to within its own population through a variety of means. Not endorsing those means, but I'm saying that the fact that there is this recognition that a meat-centered diet is bad for the health of the population and bad for the sustainability of the planet has reached the highest corridors of power in the most populous nation on Earth. So we're having an effect. All of us who are choosing day in and day out to make conscious food choices, who are choosing to learn, as we're doing right here, about where our food comes from, how it affects us, and what it means, we're having an effect. Every time you read a book, every time you watch a webinar, every time you get more informed, and then you're able to tell somebody, you're able to be a voice of wisdom or a contribution to other people. Every time you make a conscious choice with the food you eat, you are actually casting a vote right then and there that is having an impact. It's sending out ripples that are helping to build a movement. And collectively, this movement is changing the course of history. Collectively, we are changing the way people think about food, and we are changing the foods that they actually consume. Next step is we're actually going to change the way agriculture happens so that farmers grow different foods and are incentivized in different ways. And we want to change government policies. Because right now in the United States and in most developed nations around the world, we have government subsidies of so-called commodities crops. These are mostly wheat and corn and soy, other staple, so-called staple crops. And the good news is they provide calories to people who need them, and they also help farmers to have a level of security as they grow food. The bad news is we're subsidizing the worst foods. We're driving down the price of things like high fructose corn syrup and white bread and factory farmed meat. And you know what that does? It creates a competitive disadvantage in the marketplace so that wholesome and healthy foods cost more by comparison. It's a distortion. Whether you're a government intervention loving socialist or a free market libertarian capitalist, I think we can all agree that government intervening to subsidize junk foods has no place in a healthy food system, but that's what we've got going on right now. And so Food Revolution Network, we're trying to make some changes on this. We wanna see an end to government subsidies of junk foods, and we wanna see actually a subsidization. If anything, let's subsidize healthy food for low-income communities. So Double Up Bucks is one program put out by an organization called Wholesome Wave that's working directly on that. So what they do is they actually double the value of SNAP dollars, also known as food stamps, for fruits and vegetables. There's more than 500,000 Americans participating in this right now. And the research is very promising. Basically, when people get double value for fruits and vegetables, guess what? They eat more fruits and vegetables and they're healthier because of it. And their healthcare costs go down. Next step is we want to get produce prescriptions. So this is a program where doctors can prescribe fruits and vegetables to patients who have certain diseases that are responsive to consumption of fruits and vegetables, which is a lot of them, right? So then the notion is that then patients can actually get reimbursed for those costs, just like they get reimbursed for drugs if they have insurance. And Medicare and the big insurance companies will cover it. And so we're also working with Wholesome Wave to try to push this through. And there's a study out of Tufts University on it, which is very promising, which tells us that fruits and vegetables can actually be a cost-effective intervention strategy in addressing major chronic illness. And so I'm pretty excited about these two programs. They're just two examples. A third one that we're focused on right now is getting nutrition taught in medical school. You may be aware that the average physician in the United States and around the world today is graduating without any working knowledge of nutrition. In fact, out of all of the medical schools in the U.S., there are only five that have a single dedicated faculty focused on nutrition. And less than a third of the medical schools in the country are meeting the recommended amount as a minimum of getting 25 hours of nutritional education in all the years of medical training. That's the recommendation. Two-thirds are falling short of it. 25 hours. Food is the foundation of health, people. We know this, right? We're seeing study after study saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We're spending trillions of dollars every year on disease symptom management, and most of that could be prevented with a change in diet. It's estimated that more than two-thirds of our medical spending is on treating the symptoms of chronic disease. It's also estimated that 80 to 90% of our chronic illness could be prevented with changes in diet. So what does all this mean? Trillions of dollars are on the line here. And of course, the status quo is profiting off the status quo. So there's very little incentive to make a change. But we're trying to say, hey, look, doctors don't go into this business because they just want to make a buck. They generally go into the business also because they want to help people get well. And so why not give them the knowledge so they can actually help their patients? And when we've got a medical system that's buckling under patient overwhelm, why not help keep that load down by keeping people healthy in the first place, right? So that's what we're focusing on. And what we did is we worked with the American College of Lifestyle Medicine to analyze the problem. And we concluded that the root of it was the medical board exams. When medical students graduate from medical school, they are given tests and the schools teach to the tests. And the tests are administered by an organization called the National Board of Medical Examiners. In the NBME, has about 10,000 questions in their bank of questions for the medical schools to pull from. About 1,000 of them are so-called mandatory. And the rest are optional, and they can use the ones they want on their particular tests. So how many of those 10,000 questions do you think relate to diet and lifestyle to prevent illness? Well, if you guess zero, you're pretty spot on. So what we did is we worked with ACLM to create 1,000 new questions to add to the bank. And we raised a couple $100,000 to get them professionally created in the right format, in the right way. And now they're being delivered to medical schools so that schools can use them as part of their question banks. The next step is to get them widely adopted, and if enough of them adopt them widely, then the NBME can make them part of the mandatory portion of the question bank. But one step at a time, we believe that if we can change the tests, as we're beginning to do, then we can change the education in medical schools. And if we can change the education in medical schools, we can change the practice of medicine. And if we can change the practice of medicine, we believe we can uplift the health of millions of people. So these are just a few of the intervention points that we're excited about and working on. But the biggest intervention point is you and all of us and the steps we take as individuals day in and day out, because collectively we send out ripples that make an impact. And we all have our own circles of influence. We all have our own resource space. We all have our own families, friends, community, workplaces, skill sets. And I want to invite you, if you're getting inspired, if you're feeling a sense of passion or possibility around this food revolution movement, I want to invite you to see yourself not as a passive consumer, not as an exploiter, but as a participant and a co-creator, as a champion of life itself, fighting for its survival, standing for its possibility, and letting hope be alive through your actions and choices. Because you know what? Those of us who have breath in our lungs and blood in our veins and love in our hearts and dreams in our spirits, of so much to be grateful for and so much incredible possibility alive in us right now to be a part of the solution on this planet. Let's see, I want to tell a few stories as well to kind of illustrate the point here of what we're working on. I guess one that I want to talk about a little bit is an experience I had some years back. We were focusing on genetically modified organisms or GMOs. And actually, let me talk about that for a minute and then I'll come back to the story. So GMOs are a controversial topic. And let me first say, what does GMO mean? Well, some people think it means God move over, but it doesn't. It means genetically modified organism. And GMOs have been touted to be a way to help feed a hungry world by increasing crop yield, to reduce water consumption, that they would give us better nutrition and better flavor, and reduce pesticide consumption. Those all sound great. Who wouldn't want bigger yields, less water consumption, better nutrition, and better flavor, and less pesticides, right? Awesome. Only trouble is that the technology has been in the hands of companies like Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, that have their own profit motive. And what they've primarily done is create crops with one or both of two traits. One is that they're pesticide producers, which means they produce their own insecticides in every cell of the plant, so it doesn't have to be sprayed from the outside. So technically that reduces insect consumption of the plants and reduces pesticide consumption, but these insecticide producers are also themselves classified as pesticides. They are actually, you know, bugs take a bite, their stomach split open and they die. There's no known harm to humans that we know of, but we don't know for sure. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But the major trait that's been engineered into these crops is to be herbicide tolerant. So this means we can spray herbicides all over the fields and the weeds will die and the plants will live, right? And so that can save on weeding costs and, you know, which farmers, of course, can appreciate. Who wouldn't like to not have to weed? However, the bad side is that glyphosate is the primary herbicide being used here. It's primary active, or Roundup, which is the primary active ingredient in there, is glyphosate. And glyphosate is an endocrine disruptor. It's a probable carcinogen. And most people don't know this, it's been patented as an antibiotic. So it can actually kill bacteria. So what do you think happens when glyphosate gets into the human gut? Well, it's not good. It can throw off the bacterial balance. And, you know, in the last 30 years, as we've had more and more glyphosate being sprayed on our crops, we've also seen a rapid increase in the number of people suffering from food allergies, so-called leaky gut type syndromes, and other mysterious health conditions, autoimmune conditions. And a lot of these could potentially be linked to the glyphosate being sprayed on our crops. So it's a great business move, by the way, because Bayer makes glyphosate and they also make the glyphosate tolerant crops. So they're kind of creating a built-in market, and the amount of glyphosate being sprayed on our crops has increased exponentially in the last 30 years. No accident there. So glyphosate is a pesticide, and the net result of all this is that we've actually seen a net increase in pesticide use associated with GMO agriculture. But we've also seen no net increase in yield. We've seen no increase in flavor or nutritional value or reduction in water consumption. In fact, a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists on GMO agriculture and whether or not it yielded better crop outcome ended up with the title "Failure to Yield." They concluded there was no net benefit. Now, I'm not saying that there will never be a benefit from GMOs. We may at some time find crops that are of some benefit. But what I am saying is that so far, really what we've got is pesticide producers and herbicide tolerance. And neither of those traits make me as a consumer feel super great about eating these foods. So a few years back, we were focused on GMO labeling. We wanted to get a national GMO labeling solution in the United States. And we were organizing our members around this. And there were a number of states that had GMO labeling ballot measures. And one of these was the state of Washington, Initiative 527, about 5 years ago or so, and or 6 years ago. And so the state of Washington had this ballot measure up, and citizens were going to vote on whether they thought GMOs should be labeled. And it was very popular. But then a funny thing happened. A bunch of money came into the state. to fund the No on 527 campaign. And it was donated by a group called the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is kind of a consortium of the major junk food companies, if you will. And the odd thing was that there was no sense of who actually donated the money other than this one group, right? And we didn't know where did they get the money from? And Washington has campaign finance laws that make it illegal to not disclose where money actually comes from. And so they ended up donating about $30 million to this, which was the largest campaign contributions for any state initiative in the history of Washington. And with a massive amount of, I would say, lies and fraudulent ads and scare tactics, they made people think that the price of food was going to go up dramatically if GMOs were labeled, which makes no sense. Just slap a thing on a label. What is that going to do to the price of food, right? But they were all freaking people out about it. And so it ended up barely losing, just barely. But then the state law enforcement got involved, and they ended up concluding that there had been a campaign finance violation, and they forced the disclosure of who the GMA's donors were. And it was Coca-Cola and Pepsi and a bunch of other big junk food companies. And so, that ended up resulting in an ongoing lawsuit that led to the largest fine for a campaign finance violation in American history. And the GMA was essentially put out of business by the lawsuit and the fines that came in afterwards. So it's pretty much disbanded now. But that didn't stop them from pulling off their final hurrah, if you will, was to kill this ballot initiative. And so I was feeling really sad that we'd kind of lost that struggle. I wanted to get GMOs labeled, and I thought if Washington could do it, we could make that no company is going to create special labels for Washington. So it would kind of become a national thing, right? But we lost, and I was disappointed. And one day I'm in the store with my son, River. Yes, I have a son named River because the ocean refuses no river. I'm shopping for us in the store, and we pass this little smoothie section where there's Odwalla's. Odwalla is, you know, this smoothie brand that's owned by Coca-Cola, and they were bought by them some years back. And so my son River looks at me as I'm pulling up a Mango Tango Odwalla smoothie. I'm kind of hot, my blood sugar's a little low, and he's like, "So you want to give your money to Coke?" And I look at him and I'm like, well, maybe if they make more smoothies, they'll make less soft drinks, so it's good, right, to help them move in a positive direction. And he just looks at me and he's like, "So you want to give your money to Coke?" And I just stopped, and I was like, I turned beet red, and I'm like, what kind of kid am I raising over here? But I was like, okay, I gotta own it here. So I put it back on the shelf. I was like, okay, I can't do that. I can't do it. So I can't set a bad example like that for my son. And so so then I got this idea. I was like, wow, you know, if my son is calling me out on this, then maybe other people would be concerned too. And I suddenly got this concept. I was like, what if we call for a boycott, not just of Coke, but of the natural brands that they own? They own not just Odwalla, but also they also own Honest Tea. They also own Vitamin Water and Dasani and a number of other natural brands. And so we decided to launch this boycott. And we ended up getting hundreds of thousands of people to sign on, calling on Coke to stop funding the fight against GMO labeling. That was our ask. And we just said, you don't have to endorse, you know, going non-GMO. You don't have to go non-GMO. Just stop donating money to fight against it. And we ended up also reaching out to them and essentially saying, look, y'all say you support consumer empowerment, and you say you support transparency, but we think that on this issue, you are on the wrong side of history. And so we finally wound up getting some meetings with senior vice presidents at the company, traveling out to Washington, D.C. We organized the campaign in tandem with Center for Food Safety and ended up meeting with them. And you know what they said? They said, This is really interesting. We actually support national solutions on GMO labeling, and we're open to labeling if necessary, but we can't do this all by ourselves. We're just one small company. I'm like, one small company, huh? But that's what they said. They're like, but let's get our friends together. So we ended up convening a series of meetings in Washington, D.C., where senior leadership from not just Coke, but also Nestle, the world's largest food company, Unilever, also one of the biggest, also the American Beverage Association, Mars, and several other major food brands came together with leadership from Center for Food Safety, Food Revolution Network, and also Just Label It. Environmental Working Group was involved for a time, and other organizations. We all met for a whole series of meetings. I just saw, I do not have audio. How do I fix this? Oh, I think that's just from maybe one individual. Hopefully everyone can still hear me. So we ended up meeting for a whole series of meetings in Washington, and I was asked to facilitate these meetings, and we kind of created a safe space where everyone could share. And our goal was to see if we could come up with a agreed approach to GMO labeling that the food movement and the food industry could get behind together. And a lot of the folks in the industry were saying, look, we want a solution here that's national, that doesn't look like a skull and crossbones, but we also are open to some degree of consumer empowerment and transparency. And we don't like spending millions of dollars looking like we're fighting against people knowing where their food comes from and how it's produced. And so we wound up organizing these meetings, and the response was really remarkable. We found common ground, and we ended up getting attorneys from both sides working together on some joint legislation we were prepared to introduce to Congress together that would have been a national GMO labeling solution. Unfortunately, we were all set to do this when Congress passed what food movement leaders call the DARK Act, or the Deny Americans Right to Know Act. And suddenly our efforts were eviscerated because something came in to fill the gap. And it was a sort of pseudo GMO labeling law. It's now in effect. And it has means they have to label, but there's all kinds of loopholes so big it could drive a turnip truck through them. And there's also, it has to be with, in many cases, it's with QR codes, and you can scan with your smartphone on the back of a product label. And it's really not very legitimate, but it is a step. That said, we came really close to having legislation that would have been much more comprehensive and effective introduced together. And it would have been the first time in history that I'm aware of that leaders from the major food brands and leaders from the major food movement leader organizations had come together on something together. Didn't happen, but what did happen was that we built some connections and trust. And those relationships live in my heart forever. I don't know about y'all, but when I hear about some of the things that the corporate food industry is doing, it breaks my heart. It sometimes enrages me. It makes my blood boil. One of those companies is Nestle, which historically had a campaign to try to get their infant formula products distributed in the majority world, in the developing world. And they would give free formula to mothers at birth, right after they gave birth in hospitals. And they would get free formula, and it was just the amount that was necessary so that their milk would dry up. And then they'd be dependent on infant formula for the rest of their babe's nursing life, because they didn't have milk to give them. And they'd have to use water from often polluted sources. And they'd have to buy formula with money they didn't have, because their bodies couldn't give their baby what they were designed to do. And we now know, of course, that breast is best. And so whole generations of children grew up on infant formula and has suffered from serious health problems as a result. And this was a business move on the part of a company that had massive negative impact on public health. So I grew up hearing those stories. And in my mind, Nestle, also combining that with the chocolate industry and the way that people are being enslaved in the chocolate industry, Nestle was practically evil. But here I was sitting down with a senior vice president of Nestle, and we became something of friends. You know, I have twins, she has twins. We connected, we made friends, we talked about a lot of issues. We had really hard conversations. And I realized people in the junk food industry, I use that term obviously somewhat broadly, they don't stay up all night trying to figure out how to make our kids sick, how to poison the environment, how to torture animals. No, they're trying to make a living. They're trying to run their company as best they can in accordance with the best values they can manifest in a toxic food culture. And it doesn't do anybody any good if every time a company does the right thing, they go out of business. So Nestle, they'll acknowledge that most of their food is super unhealthy. As my friend pointed out to me, she said, you know, we have made it our point to try to focus on making tasty food affordable and accessible to lots and lots of people. That's been our goal. And health has been a side element. But she also said the challenge is whenever we do make healthier options, like we've tried some stuff with less sodium, less sugar, less bottled oils, more wholesome ingredients, it doesn't sell well. So it just sits there and that doesn't do anybody any good. We offer stuff that nobody buys, like that doesn't help. So I realized how important it is for organizations like ours that are mainly focused on consumer empowerment and spreading awareness to keep doing our work, because we create the demand that inspires companies like Nestle to change ingredients and practices. So I think it's all connected, right? Obviously, there's a need for some accountability and leadership at the corporate level, but I also recognize how important our work is and that in some interesting way, we're actually working together, because folks at companies like Nestle want to do the right thing and they want to be on the right side of history. They're not trying to pollute the environment. If they could make just as much money making healthy food, you bet they'd do it. But they're fundamentally economically driven creatures, and they're not even creatures. They're entities, if you will. That's what the corporate structure has created. And so as individuals, we get to participate in this and hopefully create some changes. And I'm really grateful to recognize that the food movement, if you will, is getting really broad and really diverse. And people are finding their part in it all over the world. Right now, the state of Wyoming is having all of their employees participate in a program that we created, an educational program that's giving them educational resources to help them learn about health and learn about food and implement healthier food choices. The state of Wyoming is not typically considered at the center point of the healthy food movement, but like everybody, people in Wyoming and state employees in Wyoming, they all have bodies, they all eat, and they all would rather be healthy than sick. So why not give them the knowledge they need to put this into practice? And so, you know, I think these are all examples of ways that this movement is spreading. And I just want to say you're part of it. So thank you for that. I also want to illumine for a moment the global impact of our food choices. Because, of course, food's super personal, right? What you eat literally becomes you. But it's also political. It also affects policies and practices and cultures and communities all over the globe. And the impact of it is really quite tremendous. And so let's talk about that for a moment. There was a recent study done, reported in the journal Science. Researchers analyzed 40,000 farms all over the world in 180 countries. And they looked at inputs and outputs and a whole range of factors. And they ended up concluding that that animal agriculture is responsible for 83% of all agricultural land on the planet while producing 18% of the world's calories. And they concluded that the vast majority of our agricultural water is going to animal agriculture. And they concluded that if the whole world just theoretically went vegan tomorrow, which probably is not going to happen, but just play with this here for a second, they concluded that we would free up an area of land equivalent to all of the United States, the European Union, China, and Australia combined. That's how much land would instantly be freed up, which could be used to grow sustainable organic food for future generations, which could be used for carbon sinks, could be used to reforestation programs or rewilding programs to help pull carbon out of the atmosphere. So many wonderful things we could do with that land, but we can't do it when we're using it for animal agriculture. And animal agriculture has two major components. One is land the actual animals are on, whether they're grazing or housed there. And the other is the land that's growing the feed to go to those animals. See, most of the animals in industrialized agriculture today live some or all of their lives dependent on external feedstuffs that are brought into them from agricultural land. So most of our corn, most of our soy, a lot of our other commodities crops are actually going to feed the livestock industry. This is why subsidized corn and soy equal subsidized factory farmed meat, because the feedstuffs are funded in part by the taxpayer. So when you look at the cumulative impact, you realize it takes 12 pounds of grain or soy to make 1 pound of feedlot beef, 3 or 4 pounds to make a pound of chicken, 5 to 7 pounds to make a pound of pork. All of this is essentially a protein factory in reverse. And when you look at the cumulative impact of this, you realize that we are wasting massive amounts of land, soil, water, chopping down forests to create grazing land for cattle or to create farming land on which to grow feed for cattle. All of this is having a massive impact on our climate, on our water supplies, and on the future of life on this planet. Now, here's another piece that makes this even a bit more urgent. For many decades now, humanity has grown more than enough food to feed the human population. So when we look at starvation, we're talking about issues of access and we're talking about issues of economic opportunity. We're not talking about issues of actual food available. There's been enough calories. It just hasn't been getting to people. So we've had, you could say, not a shortage of food, but a shortage of justice. However, that's starting to change. With climate change, with desertification, with groundwater depletion, with floods and salination, like water levels from the ocean rising, infiltrating more and more into coastal areas, we are now in a situation where it's getting harder to grow food on planet Earth. Meanwhile, the number of people keeps going up. And this has been intensified by the developments in Europe. So as we've seen recently in Ukraine, there has been a massive drop in the number of people able to grow food in Ukraine because they're busy fighting a war or hiding out in basements. And the result of this is that farmers are not harvesting the wheat there and they're not planting the next season's wheat. And turns out that Ukraine is something of a breadbasket for the world. So too is Russia, which has now been cut off from supplying the world through sanctions. The result of this is that these two countries together have provided 30% of the world's wheat, 12% of the world's total calories. And now with that cut off, or in some cases going fallow, we now are facing a serious food crisis. Egypt's been getting 3/4 of its wheat from Ukraine. Many countries in Africa and the Middle East have been very dependent on these two nations for a lot of their foodstuffs. So now the price of wheat has been shooting up 61% in the last couple of months. The price of other basic staples is going up. And for some people who can afford it, this is just an inconvenience. But for people who can't afford it, this is a matter of life and death. And we are now in a situation where it's very likely this year humanity will not produce as much food as we need to feed our human populations. And we could be on a course as these matters progress and as we have continued resource consumption overshoot, where billions of people could be facing starvation. I'm sorry to say this, but I think it's important to be sober about the reality. And I also want to say that there's good news here, because if we eat lower on the food chain, we can free up so much land, so much water, and so much food to feed the people who might otherwise go hungry. So I think that eating a more plant-based diet is now becoming increasingly something of a moral imperative. If you're concerned about climate change, if you're concerned about water supplies, and you recognize that it takes 2,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of feedlot beef in the US today, if you're concerned about future generations having food to eat, now is a great time to eat lower on the food chain so you can lessen your environmental impact and be a part of the solution on planet Earth. So those are some of my high-level comments. I would love to open it up for some questions now, if folks would like to ask some, and we can have some dialogue, make this a little interactive, and then maybe I'll sprinkle more stories in there. But let me hear from you all a little bit. What are you thinking? What are you wondering? How is this landing? Are we going to do this through comments, or are we going to do this through actually people raising their hands here?
I thought you'd never ask, Ocean. Thank you so much, first of all, for just a very insightful and moving presentation. We really appreciate it. And of course, everything that you're doing for all of us and the planet. And we'll get into Q&A. Real quick before we do, where's the best place again for people want to get your books or best place to contact you?
The 31-Day Food Revolution, Heal Your Body, Feel Great, and Transform Your World is my newest national bestseller. And that's available anywhere books are sold or online, of course. And you can also contact us directly, Food Revolution Network. You can go to foodrevolution.org, or what I really want to encourage folks to do is go to foodrevolutionsummit.org to register for your totally free spot in the online Food Revolution Summit, where my dad and I are interviewing 24 of the top food experts on the planet. So please check that out. Please grab your spot. We'd love to have you with us in the summit. It's an incredible event. Yeah, there's the website right there. And yeah, we're expecting 300,000 healthy food lovers in this year's summit. Opening words from Paul McCartney. Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
We're looking forward to that. Thank you. Yeah, yeah,
sure. You bet.
That's really great. That's going to be phenomenal. Pardon the sirens in the back. So as far as questions go, yeah, we typically don't take questions directly from the chat. We ask people to raise their virtual hand. For those of you in the audience that don't know how to do that, you just click on your reactions tab. You'll see different tabs in your Zoom window. Click on the reactions tab, and then a bunch of emojis pop up, and one of them says raise hand. You click there, and we'll see your raised hands come in. I'll call you by your first name when it's your turn, and I'll unmute you, and you'll be able to ask your question of Ocean. And Ocean, I see the hands starting to come in now, so if it's okay with you, we'll get moving.
Let's do it.
All right. Thank you. And so we have a first, Kaylee. Kaylee, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you, Ocean. I have to tell you that your dad's book turned my son into a vegan when your book first came out, and there have been a lot of things that happened as a result. Thank you so much. If there are thousands of people, which I know there are, who are a part of your listeners, if they would take it upon themselves to write up a curriculum for their grades to include this, whether it be history, as part of history repeating itself, because we've had desertification and all of this before in history, it could be justified under so many different subjects that teachers are supposed to go. And maybe if they write to you and you put them in groups of the grades, of what's appropriate for the different grades, maybe we could get it into schools that way. And even organize it into parent-teachers association meetings with willing parents providing vegan snacks and having that be a lure to come.
Yeah, great idea. There's an organization, healthyschoollunches.org is actually the website. So you can go to healthyschoollunches.org, and Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine runs that. And they've created a bunch of curriculum and resources for folks to advocate. So if parents, even grandparents, aunts, uncles, if you've got kids in your life who are in school, you know, schools are supposed to prepare us for the future. So shouldn't they be helping us to eat well? You know, there are lots of studies showing us that you know, nutrition has a huge impact on children's ability to learn and even their mental health. So helping kids to develop a foundation of healthy diet is so important, and that'll be a skill they have with them for the rest of their life. I can't think of anything more important really for them to learn in school. So so that's a great resource, is healthyschoollunches.org.
Thanks very much for that, Ocean. And we have a question coming in from Janet. Hi, Janet, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Ocean, for everything. I've been following you for years. My question currently though is, growing your own food at home, but in a veganic way, organic and vegan, because when you go to the stores, you know, can we trust the seeds that we buy when they say they're organic? Are they organic seeds? Do we need to buy organic seeds when we're planting or plants, or do we just, you know, the information like that, is that on your website? And as far as our soil, making it healthy without using animal products that they're all recommending. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go to foodrevolution.org, you'll find hundreds of articles on all kinds of food and health related topics. And some of them are about how to grow food in healthy ways. We don't typically use the word veganic per se. We just promote using wholesome ways to grow food, because we're just trying to reach a broad audience. But it is important how your food is growing. And you know, you don't have to sign a purity pack to be a part of the food revolution. So we all have our own parts of the journey. But the more you can support local organic, you know, healthy food production systems, the better. And the best way to do that is with growing it yourself. Then you know exactly how it was grown and what went into it. And absolutely, if you're going to be growing food and you're buying seeds or baby plants, try to get them organic because it does matter where they come from and how they start out. At the same time, again, don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. If you can't, you know, doing something that's really, really good is still better than anything else out there, even if it's not perfect, you know. There are all kinds of wonderful ways to create healthy, teeming, rich soil that's loaded with earthworms and beneficial microbes that produces super nutrient dense food. And most of them do not involve inputs of blood meal and bone meal and stuff from factory farms. If you really want healthy organic food, then the best way to do it is to use all the inputs being healthy ones that create healthy soil that don't have toxins and heavy metals and aren't not complicit in, you know, systems that you may not want to fuel with your dollars. So I totally support, you know, all of those efforts. And, you know, we actually I'm blessed to live in a little tiny eco village where we grow a lot of food. We have about 30 fruit trees. They're still babes. They're not really growing fruit yet, but they will be. And we host permaculture classes where people are coming to learn about permaculture with our land as a demo site. And so I'm learning about all kinds of awesome things like rainwater catchment and berms and swales and, you know, principles for how to keep pests out in safe and healthy ways that are good for the environment instead of destroying it. And it's companion planting. And there's just so many cool techniques you can learn. Many of them developed by indigenous peoples long ago, but we can weave them back into the modern world in ways that help us thrive.
Thanks, Ben. And let's go now to Stacy. Welcome.
Hey there. Super thankful for everything that you guys do at Food Revolution. Robbins, you have been a huge part of changing my life in addition to your dad. And I'm not sure if you are familiar with the Physicians Committee, the Food for Life program that they have. I am a Food for Life instructor and love being, I guess, kind of like a disciple of this movement. And I'm just curious if you guys have ever thought of having some sort of program to help spread, you know, the food revolution message, kind of like having instructors like that, teaching people, you know, how to even garden or to cook or anything. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. And, you know, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine has been a leader in this movement for decades, and they're doing so many good things. So definitely check out pcrm.org if you're not already familiar with them. And, you know, Food for Life is one of many programs they offer. I think, you know, that kind of hands-on mentorship, like teaching people directly in small classes and coaching and so forth, is really important. We're interested in developing more of that for ourselves. At this point, we're still creating resources that can reach lots and lots of people, because that's just how we think we can be the most efficient with a relatively small team. But, you know, one step at a time, as we grow, all kinds of things are possible. And right now we're focusing on building out new courses and resources and our website and optimizing SEO and helping our work to reach more people. We're creating a course with dietitian Brenda Davis on tackling type 2 diabetes. We've just launched a course with Dr. Mimi Guarneri on healthy heart. We launched a course with Drs. Dean and Aisha Sherzai on healthy brain. My dad and I launched a course called Plant Powered and Thriving. All of these are available on our website, along with the 14-day accelerator, which is like a 2-week crash course in getting going on the journey, our Whole Life Club membership community, the Food Revolution Summit. These are all the things we've got so far. More to come. Absolutely. There's so much. I tell you, I have new ideas every day about the stuff we should do. And then I'm like, oh, we only have so many people. But, you know, the opportunities are endless. The good news is we don't have to do it all. PCRM is already doing so much. So many other good organizations. So a lot of times we're just spreading the word and telling people about the resources that are already out there.
Thank you very much for that, Ocean. You're up to big things, and we are all glad you are. That is for sure. I'm going to bring in Sophia now. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you so much. I just bought your program, and the recipes are really amazing, mouth-watering. Thank you so much. My question, please, is do you have any idea about a book concerning sprouting for a beginner?
Sprouting, yes. Oh, I love sprouting. So good. So Doug Evans wrote a book on sprouting. He's kind of the sprout man. So you could look on Amazon for Doug Evans, and you can find that if you want to. We actually have him speaking in the upcoming Food Revolution Summit, so really excited about that. So you can see the interview. His book's called The Sprout Book, by the way. You can see an interview with him coming up in a couple of weeks. My dad will be interviewing him. Again, go to foodrevolutionsummit.org to check that out, or grab The Sprout Book online, and that's probably the best resource out there. Just a few words about sprouts. So sprouting is an incredible innovation for taking super nutrient dense foods, which are like legumes, and turning them into superstars of nutrient density. So sprouting increases the fiber content. It increases the bioavailability of the nutrients that are in the food. It increases vitamin and mineral content. It kind of brings the food to life and makes it more bioavailable, so you get more value from your food when you eat it. So sprouting is kind of awesome. And I super highly recommend it. And you can sprout, you know, mung beans, you can sprout alfalfa, of course, a lot of people do, but you can also sprout a lot of different legumes and get these super nutrient dense foods. Broccoli sprouts are one of the real champs because they're the highest source known of a compound called sulforaphane, or actually there's a couple of compounds that come together to make sulforaphane out of the broccoli sprouts. And sulforaphane is one of the most powerful antioxidants. It's incredible at fighting cancer and boosting immune health and supporting overall wellness. So we all want to get lots of sulforaphane. It's in the brassica family. You get some from cabbage. If it's raw, you get some from broccoli and other raw veggies. But actually, it turns out that broccoli sprouts are number one for sulforaphane. So sprouting them is pretty cheap. Get broccoli seeds and sprout them. And highly recommend it. And they actually taste pretty good.
Thank you so much for that. And let me go ahead. We're going to go back to Kaylee. She's got a follow-up question. Welcome back, Kaylee.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ocean. I understand that the what and the how are being addressed on the different levels of education. One of the first questions that children ask is why? And so often the why is answered by because, and people's whys are suppressed. And by the time they get to be teenagers and adults, they're not sure that there's an answer for why anymore. And I would love to see the why being addressed on all levels of age and education. Yeah. Do you have the programs for that?
Well, we don't have direct programs aimed at young people, but they are out there. And again, healthyschoollunches.org is one good resource for that. There are certainly others. The Institute for Humane Education creates wonderful programs that are focused on sort of ethics and compassion and nurturing that in young people. And there are lots of others. What I want to address in terms of the why is just to recognize that we don't all have the same why. But there are many doors in to the same place. And that same place is eating a whole foods, plant-centered diet, basing our diet around local, organic, natural, real foods instead of processed junk and animal products and mass-produced stuff, you know? And that's the kind of core, that's where we're entering. But the doors in are so many, right? For some people, they're concerned about animals. They don't want animals to be tortured in factory farms. They don't want to kill animals so they can eat. Other people are concerned about the environment or climate change and their impact on the planet. And they don't want to be consuming water or resources that could otherwise be used to feed humanity, or they want to be part of the solution on the planet. Other people are concerned about their health. They've got a disturbing diagnosis. They're feeling aches and pains. They don't want to get cancer or heart disease or diabetes, or they want to lose some weight, or they just want to have more energy or sleep better or feel better. You know, they want to have more mental clarity. They are concerned about their mental health. All of these things connect. And the good news is that, you know, whatever your motivation is, whatever your reason is, if you walk through that door, you wind up in a healthier and a more beautiful place, and you wind up contributing to a healthier and a more beautiful world. So at Food Revolution Network, we're trying to create a lot of doors in, essentially, to the same direction. And, you know, whatever your big why is, I want to invite you to connect with it. You know, whatever it is that motivates you and inspires you to be a part of this movement, or to make healthy choices, or even to learn about healthier choices, you know, this is a great time to get connected with that, to feel that fire inside you. What does it mean to you to be a part of the food revolution, to make conscious choices with your food life? And how can you let that fire inspire you and stir you and move you to go forward?
Thanks very much, Ocean. Let's go now to Lise. Welcome.
Hi. My question is about basically the corporate money in politics and how Congress and the Senate and everybody in government is not working for the people. They're working for the corporations. Now, you've got all these different, you know, different initiatives out there trying to improve things. Is there anything to get that money out of politics? Is there any hope? Or is it going to have to come from the bottom up?
I mean, I'm always an indomitable optimist. I believe there's always hope. You know, humans collectively create systems, and then the systems shape us, but we also create them, and we can change them, you know, collectively. And as we learn better, we can do better, and we can create better. So, you know, I absolutely have hope. And I think that change can come from anywhere. It can come from the bottom up. It can come from the top down. More often than not, it comes from the bottom up. You know, there's the old saying, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. And I think that more often than not, that's how it has to roll. But we absolutely shouldn't give up on policy. You know, I'm friends with Senator Cory Booker, who is the only vegan in the US Senate. And, you know, he's working with across the aisle with Senator Tester to help create regulations around factory farms, because Senator Tester is himself a farmer in Montana, Republican, not a vegetarian by any way, shape, or form, but he cares about animals, and he's horrified by the way that the industrialized food industry is making it harder for family farms to exist or even to do the right thing when it comes to animal welfare. So they're actually trying to find points of alignment and agreement around some of those issues. And Senator Booker is a Democrat, and Senator Tester is a Republican, and they're coming together. And you know, I personally think that, you know, all the major political leaders are heavily influenced by money. And the sad reality is that the folks who are profiting from the status quo are the ones that can invest that money to keep the status quo in place. And the biggest lobbying industry in the political world today is the pharmaceutical industry. They spend enormous sums of money trying to influence policy. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry does not want us to be healthy. You know, they may say that, but at the end of the day, their business model depends on us being sick and being dependent on medications in order to live. And so, you know, there are all kinds of ways that they use their influence to make profits. And I will say the United States, with 5% of the world's population, is responsible for 75% of global pharmaceutical industry spending. So when we talk about how much of our GDP is going to medical care or disease symptom management, huge amount of that is tied to the profits of big pharma and the way that we are hooked on drugs for our survival. And of course, I recognize that some of these medications are lifesavers, and there's no doubt we should all be grateful for whatever medicines actually help us. But we should never think that health comes from a bottle of pills. Health comes from the way we eat and live and the choices we make and nurturing the terrain, the ecosystem that is vibrant and healthy. And occasionally when something breaks down, a medicine may be a benefit, but that should be the last resort, not the first line of defense against sickness. And so back to a policy level, we need policies that recognize this, that focus on supporting human health and nutrition in the communities that need it most. And you know, we all have a stake in this. Like the notion that, for example, trying to uplift the health of low-income communities is something that only affects the poor is ridiculous. You know, if somebody is sick, they're going to be a drain on society. They're more likely to end up in crime situations. They're more likely to end up in prison. They're more likely to cause problems for other people. They're more likely to depend on government handouts later in life for their survival because they're sick, because they couldn't get ahead in life, because they couldn't have the mental clarity to succeed in the workplace, because they didn't have the energy to keep going, and they had to spend time being dependent on the care of others. So when we are able to empower people to make healthy and life-giving choices by giving them the nutrients they need to thrive, they become givers rather than takers. And what's the impact of that on a whole society, on a broad systemic level? I don't know anybody who wants to be just a taker. Most people in their heart of hearts would rather give. They'd rather contribute if they can. But a lot of people are suffering and hurting. And a lot of that comes back to food. And statistically, in the US today, the poorer you are, the darker your skin color, the more likely you are to base your diet and to be depend for your diet on foods that fuel chronic illness, and the more likely you are to suffer from chronic disease. When you're suffering from chronic disease, you have less energy, less vitality, less capacity, less go-get-em energy, less ability to make wise and healthy choices. So it's easy to blame folks for the cycles they get caught in. But as a society, unless we focus on uplifting the health and the wellness of the populations that need it the most, unless we stop subsidizing junk food and start supporting people at the most basic level and having the basic foundations of health met, we're going to continue to suffer like this. And there's going to continue to be some people who are fundamentally left out or leave themselves out because of the choices that they make when their brain isn't at its best. So I think this is all connected. And my vision is we need policies that support health and invest in health rather than subsidizing junk food and then doing big favors to big pharma so that people stay stuck in a cycle of misery. Looks like that might be all of our questions for this moment. So let me just keep going a little bit. People can raise their hands again if they want to ask more.
That would be great. Thank you, Ocean.
Awesome. Yeah. So I actually want to get a little bit. I'll touch on the broader political dimension with one more lens that I think is important. Then I want to get a little personal again. So the broad thing is, I want to say that I think that food 1.0 is about survival. If you can get enough calories to fill your belly, that is success. And for most of human history, that's been the central goal of food, and the food system has been to survive. And for many people in the world, that's still the biggest goal of food, just survival, you know? But when you get food 1.0 covered, then we move to food 2.0. And that central organizing principle of food 2.0 is commerce. It's the buying and selling of goods. And it's brought us a huge range of flavor and taste and texture and cuisine, you know, from all over the world for remarkably low prices. Even though food prices are skyrocketing, we still spend less of our total income on food than humans ever did historically. And so we've gotten a little bit spoiled, if you will, to have supermarkets with gazillions of different kinds of options right there. And the prices are still on the low end of our GDP compared to, for example, medical care. But that's what food 2.0 has brought us. And you know, it's tasty and it's made the consumer the king, if you will. Unfortunately, food 2.0 is morally bankrupt and it's killing us. It's killing our bodies and it's killing our planet and it's torturing animals, which is why I think we need to move to food 3.0, where the central organizing principle of our food system is health. Health for us and health for our world. And there are plenty of healthy profits to be made in food 3.0. It's just that they come from healthy food. And so that to me is a central organizing principle in our food revolution. Now, a lot of us might be wondering, how do we influence people? You know, you probably have people who don't eat as healthfully as you do or as you wish they did. You probably know some people you wish you could share this with, but maybe they won't listen to you. So how do you influence folks? Well, to get into that, I'm going to tell a little story and then I'll circle it back. So this is super personal. I'm a dad, as I mentioned earlier. I have twin sons, Bodhi and River, and they were born prematurely, 9 weeks early, and they're on the autism spectrum. And so, you know, early on, we didn't know if they'd ever talk. We didn't know if they'd ever walk. Thank goodness they did. They're miracles. They have to work extra hard to do things other people take for granted. And they're amazing. They're in a college class right now and graduated high school with honors. And they're amazing kids. I just love my kids so much with all my heart. And our son River also had a really rough start. And in his first 10 years, he never made eye contact with me. We never had that experience of just dropping in and looking in each other's eyes and feeling connected. And I'd given up. I thought that would never happen. But then we discovered a program called Sunrise, S-O-N-R-I-S-E, which focuses on a kind of autism treatment where instead of training kids to behave differently, instead you focus on building connection with them, building relationship with them, including building eye contact with them. So one day I'm spending some time with my son River, and he's chewing on a Barbie doll's foot, which was one of his passions at the time. He's 10 years old and he's chewing on a Barbie foot and totally oblivious to me, it seemed. And instead of worrying, oh my God, this plastic's probably made in China, what toxins are leaching into his bloodstream, or how is my kid ever going to have a dating life if he chews on Barbie feet all day long? Instead, and yanking it out of his mouth and being like, hey kid, this is our time together. Pay attention. I'm here. You know, instead, I decided to join him. So I'm sitting across the room from him and I pick up another Barbie and I start chewing on her foot, just like he is. And I'm getting into it. And at that moment, River looks at me. And this huge grin comes over his face. And I could almost hear him thinking, oh my God, there is intelligent life on this planet. he's like, wow, he gets it. And he's looking at me and we're chewing on Barbie feet and we're beaming in each other's eyes. First moment of eye contact with my son in his life. And we're beaming in each other's eyes, chewing on Barbie feet, for what felt like an eternity. And then he gestures like this. Turns out his Barbie has 2 feet. He's inviting me to come chew on the other foot of his Barbie. So now I come over and we're 3 inches apart, still just completely locked, beaming in each other's eyes. I've got a tear rolling down my cheek and we're chewing on Barbie feet. And it's the moment of like first contact with my kid, you know, in his life. And it was so profound. That moment has been repeated in other forms since. She doesn't chew on Barbie feet anymore, but we still have moments when, you know, a song comes on or he tells a joke or we have a connection and we look in each other's eyes. And there's this moment of just beaming connection, soul to soul, beyond autism, beyond even parent child. We're just two beings looking at each other, feeling kinship and connection. And here's the thing. What does all this have to do with influencing other people? Well, quite a bit, actually. Dr. Martin Luther King once said, you have no moral authority with those who can feel your underlying contempt. When we judge people, when we pathologize them, we lose moral standing in the relationship. And when that happens, we lose connection with them as well. People know when you respect their dignity. People can tell when you understand their intrinsic motivation. And people know when you're judging them, when you're looking down on them, when you think you know better than them, when you're blaming them, when you think there's something wrong or broken about them, and that's what you're focused on. There's an old saying that what we appreciate appreciates. What you focus on tends to expand. When you focus on building connection, when you focus on building relationship, when you focus on unconditional love, people know that. And it's so important if you want to influence somebody's food choices to first recognize that unconditional love is palpable. It matters. It's real. When you know who somebody is, when you're connected with their integrity and their spirit, when you feel aligned with their basic essential goodness, they feel that. You probably have people in your life that respect you and love you and you feel better around them. You've probably got people in life that tend to judge you and you feel bumbly and small and kind of at your worst around them. You know the difference that I'm talking about. So we get to be that for other people. And when you're a stand for somebody's dignity or goodness, or even truth-telling, knowing that they want that, knowing that that's their ground of being, is this is a human being who wants the truth, who you respect enough to tell the truth to. If that's the ground of being, then you're still in a place of fundamental right relationship with their soul. And when we're in right relation with people's soul, we have moral standing in the relationship and we have the capacity for positive impact. However, when we lose that right relation, when we shut that down, we become capable of debasement and disrespect. And I see this honestly as one of the roots of the way humans are treating animals. When we treat them as lesser and disrespect, and we don't recognize that they're sentient beings, we become capable of torturing them in factory farms, normalizing that. And of course, the result is it comes back to us in the form of heart attacks and disease that sickens us. Similarly, when we disrespect other human beings, we become capable of war and violence. Well, the same is true on a micro level when you disrespect somebody on a basic level by not honoring the integrity of who they are. And so when it comes to food choices, I always want to remember that people deserve to be the author of their own lives and their own choices. And I never want to try to rob that from them and think I know better than them, even if I do think I know better than them. And you know what? I often do think I know better than them, right? I do. I probably do know better than them. I've spent decades in this, right? They probably haven't. But at the same time, I don't know better than them what they've been through. I don't know better than them what makes them tick. I don't know better than them what their intrinsic motivations are or what drives them, what moves them, what inspires them, what they long for, what they were born for, what their purpose in life is. I don't know that better than them. And so I want to be in respect for that. I want to be in partnership with that. And then I want to find the door in, hopefully, that will work. So tactically speaking, you may want to give people books. You may want to give them films. You may want to give them courses or online resources. Tell them about the Food Revolution Summit. Tell them about this program right here. Let them know about it. It's often easier to have an expert tell them than to try to tell them yourself, because people don't necessarily listen to their friends or family, but they may listen to an expert. Little trick Dr. Neil Barnard gave me that I still use. If you're giving somebody a book, slap a post-it note on there that says, I thought of you on page 176 or 215 or whatever it is, some spot that made you think of them that you think they might especially connect with. And I'll bet you they're going to open at least to that page. They'll be curious what made you think of them. Same thing with a film. Tell them, hey, I thought of you at, you know, 1 hour and 17 minutes in or 27 minutes in or whatever it is, some spot that you felt especially landed or connected. They may or may not watch the whole thing, but the odds go up dramatically of them engaging when you pinpoint some spot that felt relevant, you know. And you can also invite people to talk about it afterwards. You can also host potlucks, share food with people, healthy, wholesome food. Sometimes they say the best doorway to a person's heart is their stomach, right? So give people healthy food that's nourishing and tastes good, and they'll be amazed. They'll be like, oh my gosh, this tastes good. There's no beef in that. You know, it tastes really good. So find the doorways in and recognize that for somebody who's used to a super standard American diet, you may have to choose something that isn't super pure. You know, maybe use some beyond meat in there or some other thing that maybe if you're a super pure foodist, you wouldn't normally eat, but maybe you want to bring it in just to be a bridge to help make it a little more familiar to people so they can test it out and find something they like. You know, I don't give people, you know, pure broccoli juice for their first healthy meal necessarily, you know, so find the ways to sweeten it up. Spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, and then also introduce healthy food step by step. But sharing yummy, healthy foods with people is a great step. And then if you want support for yourself, get a potluck thing growing. Connect with other people and say, everyone, let's bring something delicious and healthy together, you know, or even a meal sharing program. You can do cooperatives where people at work, like, I'll bring food on Monday for the three of us. You bring it on Tuesday. Here's the thing, folks. It's always faster to make twice as much on a per calorie basis. It doesn't take twice as long to make twice as much food. So when you cook in quantity, you're able to, you know, pay it forward for the rest of your week, so you have leftovers and you also can share with other people, which can build social connection. And then if they do the same, then that'll save you time as well. So sharing, connecting, letting food be a doorway for building relationships is a powerful stepping stone you can take. Also just remember to always love people. They'll have their own timing and their own rhythm. You know, I have friends that still continue to eat, you know, junk food quite a bit, even though I've told them all kinds of things about it. But every so often something gets in and they try something a little different. And I just want to say, I love you no matter what you eat. You know, I really do. You know, what matters most is that we have love in our hearts, that we have connection. And on top of that, I want you healthy and alive long term. And I'm really happy to see you making choices that might support that. So those are a few ideas for influencing other people in constructive and positive ways. I hope some of those are helpful. I want to share with you a quote that means a lot to me from Samuel Ullman. I used to do youth leadership work a lot and reflect a lot on what the youthful spirit is. And it struck me that youth isn't about a stage of life, actually. You know, it's about an attitude. And Samuel Ullman said it really well. He said, youth is not a time of life. It's a state of mind. It's not a matter of rosy cheeks and red lips and supple knees. It's a matter of the will, a quality of the imagination, a vigor of the emotions, a freshness of the deep springs of life. Youth means a temperamental predominance of courage over timidity, of an appetite for adventure over a love of ease. This often exists in an adult of 60 more than a youngster of 16, for we do not grow old merely by a number of years. We grow old by deserting our ideals. Years may wrinkle the skin, but to give up enthusiasm wrinkles the soul. Worry, fear, self-distrust bows the heart and turns the spirit back to dust. Whether 60 or 16, there is in every human being's heart the lure of wonder, the unfailing childlike appetite of what's next. In the center of your heart and my heart, it's as if there was a wireless station. So long as it receives messages of beauty, hope, cheer, courage, and power from people and from the infinite, so long are you young. So I want to honor the youth in all of us, as well as the elder in all of us. The elder, I think, is the one that can learn from experience and grow and discover. But we also only become an elder through living our days. If we die our days, if we give up on life, we will not learn and we will never become elders. And I think a true elder never ceases to be a learner. There's an old saying that in the world to come, the learned shall inherit the earth. In the world to come, the learners shall inherit the earth while the learned find themselves exquisitely prepared for a world that no longer exists. So I think we all want to be learners, don't we? We all want to be inhabitants of that youthful spirit that moves through us, that helps us learn, discover, and create. And it's interesting how these positive feedback loops go, because when you choose healthier foods, you have more mental clarity, you have more energy, you feel more youthful, you have less aches and pains, you feel better. And that makes it easier to make wise choices, to make self-empowering choices, to make health-boosting choices. Oftentimes, people have their binges. They find themselves on the wrong end of an empty bag of cookies or chips late at night when they're tired and stressed, going through breakups, going through tough times at work. The harder things get, the more likely we are to seek comfort from foods that make us sick. But it's not very comfortable to be sick. It's not very comfortable to have your body in pain. So those are negative feedback loops. But the positive feedback loops are when you can break the cycle, when you choose healthy food, you're telling your body, I love you, I care about you, you're worth investing in, and you're building up cycles of positivity and joy and pleasure and vitality and wellness that can radiate through to every cell of your body and that help you make better choices that in turn help you be more attractive, help you be more enjoyable, help you love your life more, and help you be more fun to be around. You have more vitality in your being, which then becomes a magnet towards other people who in turn are drawn to that. So when you're really lit up and well and filled with vitality, people will want what you have. They'll want to be more like you. They'll want to be more connected to you. And that, I think, is another way you influence people. When you make healthy choices, you become an embodiment, a living ambassador, if you will, for a more vital, joyous, radiant life. And that is powerful, powerful stuff. If you have more questions, please do feel free to raise them. If you have comments or reflections, please feel free to raise them. You can raise your hand in the chat here. Love to engage more with y'all if there's more to ask here. And let's see. Otherwise, I will keep on sharing. I certainly have more stories I can talk about. One thing I want to talk about, back to this notion of influencing other people, is a little bit of an embarrassing story from my own childhood. When I was in second grade, I decided to speak out about food. I was raised a vegetarian. And in second grade, I decided I was going to be an ambassador for that amongst my classmates. And I didn't have the best social skills at the time. So what I started doing was going through at lunchtime, and my classmates had their Cabbage Patch dolls and Star Wars lunchboxes, and I'd go through the schoolyard and I'd interrogate them about what they were having for lunch, and then I'd kind of shame them. So I had, you know, friends who were like having their roast beef sandwich, and I'd asked them if they believed in the death penalty for murder and if they were aware that that beef came from a cow that had been murdered. And, you know, it didn't go over very well. And one day, actually, my friend Damien and I got in a fist fight, and by the end of it, his meat was in the garbage and I was in the principal's office. And I started thinking about the fact that I was advocating for peace and nonviolence in our food choices, and I was getting in a fist fight with my best friend over the contents of his lunchbox, and realized there was something a little bit incongruous about that. So I ended up thinking about that some more and realizing, gosh, there's got to be a better way to influence people than this. And so I started focusing on fitness. I was like, well, if I'm super healthy, then I can be an example to other people, and they'll realize that you can be really healthy and eat, you know, not eat animals. And I got pretty good at it. I set school records in elementary school, not a big deal, but, you know, school records for push-ups and pull-ups and also running. And I wound up when I was 10, I ran a marathon. My school was hosting a jogathon, and we were running around a quarter mile track, and people were making donations to the school for every mile, for every lap we'd run around the quarter mile track. And I wound up running 105 laps, which is 26 and a quarter miles. So people got some really big bills. They'd pledge like, oh yeah, I'll give $5 a lap. They thought maybe they'd give $20 to the school because I'd run a mile or something. Then they get a bill and they're like, So I don't know how the school did collecting on all that. But for me, it was really empowering to realize that I could be so healthy on a plant-based diet. And that's continued for me through my whole life. And now we're getting films like The Game Changers showing us that actually all kinds of superstar athletes perform better on a plant-based diet with lower rates of inflammation and more vitality and less excess pounds and more nutrition. And that can be good for longevity. And, you know, a lot of folks at when they're like in high school or college, early in their pro career, athletes, it doesn't matter a whole lot what they eat because they just need a lot of calories. But as they get older, the impact of the modern diet shows up, and we see so many superstar athletes retiring, you know, in their mid-20s, late 20s, because their bodies are breaking down because they're under so much stress. And so having anti-inflammatory foods is critical. And we're seeing more and more athletes discovering this. And so most of the superstars that have been in there at a really high level for a really long time tend to get more and more plant-based. And that trend's probably going to continue because the truth is getting out. I see we've got a question here from Kaylee. Should we take that one?
You do, you bet. Thank you so much for all of this, Ocean. And I'll unmute Kaylee now.
Welcome back. David. Just a minute. Okay, I don't know if he'll be calling me. I don't know what to do.
Hi, Kaylee. We can hear you.
Oh, I can't. Hello. Hi. Thank you. I realized that I was withholding information from you, Ocean. And I want to acknowledge your dad fully, because when I read The Diet for New America to David at 4 years of age, he looked up and he said halfway through, he said, "Mommy, I'm never going to eat anything that had a mommy or daddy again." And when he, as he grew up, he was working for Dr. True North Health Center, and then he became the scientific advisor for Game Changers, and that's just so much in our family, and it all started with your dad and with Diet for New America. So anybody in the audience who wants to help their children to understand things more clearly, read them Diet for a New America, for yourself and for your children.
Okay. Oh, how fantastic. Thank you, Kaylee. That is a wonderful story. What's your son's name?
David Goldman.
Okay, fantastic. That's great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your family. Thank you for all of you. Thank you.
What a beautiful story.
Thank you for letting me share that. Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So I think I want to close with a story and a quote for our time together here today. And the story is about a chicken farmer, interestingly enough, by the name of Craig Watts. Craig's from North Carolina. And, you know, his family had been in the chicken business for some time. And when I first learned about Craig, he was running a Purdue-associated chicken farm. Farm is a kind of euphemistic term. We should really call it a chicken factory. You know, 10,000 birds in one barn. A barn is maybe euphemistic too. And the situation was pretty sad. His birds were, and this is typical in the industry, they had less than 1 square foot per bird. And they're all packed together in this massive warehouse. They never see the sun or a blade of grass or touch dirt in their entire lives. They're living on chicken feces. You know, they're not just their own, but from generations before them. The barn was cleaned every couple of years. So multiple generations of birds would live, get fattened up, and die in that barn before they would clean it. And they are bred to be morbidly obese, sort of the equivalent to if a human child was bred to be 600 pounds by the time it's a few months old. And so they fatten up so fast, so unnaturally fast, that they couldn't walk. So they'd be lying there in feces, and they develop sores, and their feathers, they lose feathers, and some of them get very sick. About 5% of the birds would die before they were killed for slaughter. So there's dead bodies and sick birds all around lying in feces. And, you know, Craig hated doing this, but this is what he was told to do. He was actually in his contracts with Purdue, was forbidden to let them have any windows open or see sunlight, because that would stimulate activity, which would drive down feed conversion ratio. So this was what he was doing. He felt terrible about it, but he had to make a living, and he felt stuck. And he had huge debts from getting into the business. And so then he sees an ad on TV. Jim Purdue is telling people in this ad, he's saying, "We treat our chickens well, and, you know, healthy meat comes from healthy chickens. And, you know, we believe in doing the right thing." And they show this like super clean barn with no manure and lots of space on the TV ad. And he said, "Our chickens are happy and they're healthy." And Craig sees this ad, and his blood just starts boiling. And he's like, he said, I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but I can tell you these chickens are not happy. And he said, and I'm not a doctor, but I can tell you these chickens are not healthy. So that man is lying about what's happening in my barn and all the other barns out there. And that's not okay. So Craig had had enough. So he invited Leah Garces from Compassion and World Farming, now the director of Mercy for Animals, to come in with cameras to film an award-winning Purdue chicken farm, which Craig ran. Won lots of awards for his productivity. And so they came in with cameras and they made a little film. And this is not an undercover investigation. This is a chicken farmer telling people what happens in the industry. And the video went up on YouTube and it went viral, and it became a national media sensation, and millions of people saw it. And Purdue was not happy, and they summoned Mr. Watts, and they had some conversations, and they penalized him and tried to make it look like he was just a bad apple. Like what was happening there wasn't the standard of practice in the industry. He pointed out that they'd been visiting his farm twice every week, signing off, saying he was doing great. He'd won multiple awards for his excellence in chicken farming. This is the norm, folks. So Craig exposed that truth. After a little while, he and Purdue were not getting along very well. He exited the chicken industry. Now he's growing row crops on his land, and he has become a consultant to help factory farmers transition to more sustainable and healthy livelihoods. Bless Craig Watts for his courage, right? I mean, what courage that took for him to risk his livelihood, his family's survival, even financially, to tell the truth. But he did, and now he's on a new path. And people like him, people like my grandpa, who founded Baskin-Robbins and then ended up giving up ice cream and seeing the benefits, these kind of people have incredible courage. And it makes me look at us, you and me, and the choices we make and say, you know what, if Craig Watts could face that, if my grandpa could face that, maybe there's hope for the rest of us. You know, maybe just possibly we can find the courage to make changes too. Maybe we can be a part of the solution on planet Earth. Maybe we can spread the word. And my hope today, my secret agenda is to light a fire in you. I want to light a fire in you of a place that says enough is enough of a toxic food culture. And it's not enough to just do the right thing in your personal life. That's a great start. But from there, I want to light a fire in you that sees yourself as a part of a movement that is changing the way we eat, changing the way we process food, changing the way that we relate to food. a movement that says it's time to build a food revolution. It's time to be a part of the solution on planet Earth. It's time to be a practitioner, yes, but also an activist, an advocate in your own unique, creative way. You don't have to shove ideology down people's throats, but you can spread the truth, you can spread the word, and you can realize the power that comes from knowing your life has meaning and purpose bigger than yourself. And I'll close with a quote from George Bernard Shaw. He said, "This is the true joy in life, to be used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, to be a force of nature instead of a feverish clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy." He said, "I am a member of the community, and as a member, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can before I die. Life is no brief candle to me. It is more of a splendid torch, which I want to make burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." So I want to thank you for all the ways that you burn your candle or your torch as brightly as you can. All the ways that you choose to eat and live in accordance with your core values. You deserve the gift of health. And this planet deserves you, vibrant, well, and contributing to the lives of others. So I thank you so much for your time, for your attention, and for your partnership in the food revolution. Let's do this.
Thank you, Ocean. Thank you so, so much for this. Incredibly moving and inspirational. We all really, really appreciate it. And we're looking forward to seeing you at the summit. And I know I'm not the only one that wants to thank you. So we're going to have our tech team unmute our entire audience. What does everybody want to say to Ocean Robbins?